With me now on Fresh Air is Armistead Maupin, whose writing attracted a large and devoted following in San Francisco beginning in 1976 when the San Francisco Chronicle published his newspaper serial, Tales of the City. The only newspaper feature of its kind, Tales of the City was a hip, ironic, post-countercultural newsprint soap opera. The serial detailed the continuing stories of the romances and professional crises of the two main characters, a gay man and a straight woman, who each rent apartments in the same boarding home. When Tales of the City ended, the San Francisco Chronicle received 20,000 letters. The overwhelming response made it possible for Maupin to write a new round of episodes. He's rewritten each of the series from the Chronicle into novel form. They're titled Tales of the City, More Tales of the City, Further Tales of the City, and Baby Cakes, which is the latest. Television rights for Tales of the City were purchased by HBO. Armistead grew up in North Carolina and joined the Navy after graduating from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's gay and came out while he was in the service. Since 1971, he's lived in San Francisco, where he first moved to accept a position with the Associated Press. Baby Cakes and all the Tales of the City novels are published by Harper & Row. Armistead Maupin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
How'd you get the idea for doing a newspaper serial? Who's ever heard of such a thing?
Well, it grew out of the fact that I couldn't get people to give me a straight line about a particular story I was trying to cover for the Pacific Sun in Marin County. A woman that I knew at the time told me that a lot of singles were cruising at the Marina Safeway, that there was this sort of hetero cruising scene on Wednesday nights. And I went to the Safeway and tried to get people to tell me, to admit to what they were doing, and of course that they would not do anything of the kind. So very frustrated, I went home and I made up this character, Marianne Singleton, put her into the situation, tried to figure out a way to make the whole thing come around full circle, and decided that, of course, when she finally met the man that she liked, he was going to be there with another man at the grocery store. And that was the birth of the two characters, Marianne and Michael. And I just got kind of fascinated with them and thought about following their adventures through the city. So I approached the editors of the Pacific Sun, asked them if I could write a serial in which these characters would explore various lifestyles, gay and straight. And we called it The Serial. It ran for just 5 issues of the paper because this was the San Francisco edition of the Pacific Sun, and it folded. But the editors liked the idea so much that they kept it around for their Marin edition, and Syra McFadden subsequently started her own using the same title and made it into a book, and eventually a movie was made of it. But I took the idea to the Chronicle a year or so later, when Mary Hartman was going full tilt, and convinced them that this sort of thing would work in a paper. It hadn't been in a newspaper for something like 25 years, and it was very unrespectable. The editor was the name for which I am very grateful, Tales of the City, was the product of the editor of the paper, who said he wanted to make damn sure that people understood that it was fiction, hence Tales, and that it was about San Francisco. And in San Francisco, everybody calls it The City.
There's cartoon strips like Doonesbury, for instance, which are kind of similar in that there's a lot of young, neurotic, crazy characters, and it's a continuing story, but it's a comic. Did you ever have trouble convincing the Chronicle that a prose version of something like that could work in a newspaper?
Well, they bought the idea right away, oddly enough, but the development of it was what was tough. They made me write 6 weeks' worth, and they went over every inch of it trying to figure out if it was going to offend anyone. They didn't know I was gay at the time, and I thought this is a radical enough idea to propose this soap opera than to tell them that – make them think I had any kind of an axe to grind, particularly on that subject. So I kept out the gay character until episode 31, which was just beyond 6 weeks.
Were they surprised when the gay character entered?
They were, and they said it was all right. In the words of the managing editor, he said, "We don't mind your writing about the gay lifestyle as long as you make it seem so weird that it doesn't look like the Chronicle is endorsing the practice," which I thought was very amusing, as if the Chronicle's endorsement would have anything at all to do with whether people actually committed themselves to the lifestyle.
So what did you do to make this character so kinky that it wouldn't look like an endorsement by the Chronicle?
I didn't. I did just the opposite. I wrote the most romantic mainstream scenes I could think of for the gay characters.
Such as?
Well, just a simple kiss between two men on a pier in the moonlight that never went beyond that. But which made the point that gay men and women are every bit as romantic in their dealings with each other as heterosexuals, that it's essentially just a human confrontation. I think that's what was so radical about it in the early days, was that it did remove it from that realm of the lurid and the sensational and simply treated it in the same matter-of-fact way I treated the romantic foibles of the straight characters.
Did they ever have like lists where they'd number the number of gay characters, the number of straight characters?
How did you guess? Did somebody tell you that? They did.
They really did that?
There was a chart, which used to make me laugh so much because I'd come in at the end of the week and the managing editor would look at the what I'd written for the week, and he'd take the as a new character was introduced, he'd decide whether the character was gay or straight and put it into the proper column.
To keep score?
He didn't want the gay characters to rise above one-third of the total number of characters because he figured that was the population of the gay population of San Francisco. So I used to sit around and we had a great relationship. He was a kind of crusty 60-year-old who was always sitting there and shaking his head and saying, I can't understand why a fine young man like you isn't going out with beautiful women, you know. He was concerned about me. And I used to sit around and try to think up ways to outrage him. So I created a scene in which Franny, my alcoholic Hillsboro matron, passes out in her herb garden and is ravaged by her Great Dane and subsequently has an affair with the Great Dane, which the managing editor was obliged to put into the heterosexual column. Once we got to this, it got so da-da that he finally just let it go. And he realized, most important of all, that everybody was enjoying it and, you know, that there weren't – when the gay character was threatened in the second year of the serial with a paralyzing disease, he was so well known by the readers at that point that I was getting flowers at the Chronicle with Get Well cards. And one woman wrote in and said, I'm nothing but a straight housewife with three little machos of my own, but if you kill Michael Tolliver, I'll never subscribe to the Chronicle again. And that was really, you know, that was my dream, that I could create a character that was likable and believable and human enough that people would simply like him on a human level, would realize that he wasn't this great monster, you know.
Well, there are romances that the heterosexuals and the gay characters have. What kind of guidelines were you given about how explicit any of the sex scenes could get?
It's very funny at the Chronicle. You never know from one day to the next. I did notice, and this is kind of interesting because this was in the days before the hunks happened, before they were acknowledging the fact that women actually notice men's bodies. And I would write scenes in which Marianne would see a man coming across the room and she'd recognize his thighs first, say. And the male managing editor would cut that out because he felt, you know, sensitive about it. It seemed sexual to him because it was a woman observing a man sexually. On the other hand, there were plenty of tits and ass jokes that got through with no problem at all when it was a man observing a woman. So I could see, it was interesting for me as a gay man because I could see the ways in which the oppression of women, if you will, was equated to that of gay men because it was simply out of the question that a man should be regarded in a sexual manner at all.
My guest is writer Armistead Maupin, and we're discussing a series of novels that he's written. The series in the newspaper was called Tales of the City, and then there's several Tales of the City novels that have been written, the latest of which is called Baby Cakes and has just been published by Harper & Row. When you started the series, it was in 1976.
Right.
And times have changed
a lot
since then. How have some of the characters changed? What are some of the changes you put Michael and Marianne through?
Marianne has probably been the most dramatic. She started out as a secretary from Cleveland who left, who decided on the third day of a five-day vacation that she wasn't going to leave San Francisco and got a job as a secretary in San Francisco. And she was enormously naive, and she was seeing the whole thing, the gay life there and everything, for the first time, and you saw sort of her apprehension and fear. And she's gradually grown more and more independent to the point that she's now a news person, if you will, for a local television station, and somewhat a little star in her own right in San Francisco. Her husband, who was the man that she liked the least when she first met him, who was a sort of roué, swinging single bachelor who haunted the did one-night stands at the singles bars, is a very good-looking man who is not really as smart as she is, who adores her, and she adores him, and she has no problem with a relationship. But because he's essentially not very ambitious, he's continually threatened by the rise in her career. And a lot of that is being dealt with in Baby Cakes. The fact that it's really a situation now that there are lots of women out there who are more powerful and influential than their husbands, who don't find that an unnatural situation. And their husbands really secretly don't mind it, but they keep feeling the societal pressure to deal with it in some way.
Plus, he wants to have a baby.
Plus, he wants to have a baby. And she's anxious to become an anchor person, and she knows that having a baby is going to postpone that just a little bit longer.
Well, we won't tell about how that's resolved.
No. The pressure's on, too, because they're in that classic situation of she's 32 and he's 38, and they've got to take some sort of action.
And what's happened to Michael in the last 8 years?
Michael's been through a little bit of every, a lot of the gay experience, really. He's been through a fag bashing, and it's been a sort of constant romantic quest, a kind of growing up experience. He's felt disillusioned by the gay culture in many ways, has gradually learned to become an individual, not just to see himself as a gay man. And as the new book opens, his lover has died of AIDS, and so he's having to deal with that, with grief at a relatively young age, and trying to put his life back together in the meantime.
Yeah, there are some really shockingly serious things that happen in this humorous series of novels and in the serial in the paper. For instance, like the fag bashing, like he's in the car with Brian, who's the lover, now husband of Marianne, and they get beat up by these guys. These guys don't know that the other man is straight, and they both get beat up, and Michael goes through these feelings of guilt that somehow it's his fault that the straight man got beat up. And it's a very serious part of what's otherwise, you know, a very humorous book. And it's always, whenever you do that, whenever one of your characters dies or something, I don't think the readers are really prepared for it.
No, and I guess that's partially a trick on my part, I must admit. I mean, it's a way of driving home the truth harder than if you have a serious, glum novel all the way through. People are sort of ready for it. I think that's the effectiveness of humor, because that's the way it happens in real life. We're going along lighthearted one day and having a wonderful time and feeling great about things, and tragedy comes out of the blue, really. And I try to show the ways in which that happens, and then again the ways in which humor comes in to rescue you from the tragedy, the way you have to be constantly using your imagination, I guess, to make the world a better place. Because I like to think of it as a kind of a romantic fatalism that Tales of the City puts across, an attitude that the bottom line is that things aren't too terrific, you know, that that life is tough, and that we have to construct the goodness for ourselves. We have to go out and look for it. We have to make life beautiful. It doesn't come to you. But if you do, if you seek those things out and seek out other people who are striving for the same things, then it works for you, and miracles happen. There are a lot of so-called coincidences in tales. I really like to think of them as miracles, and they are miracles in my own life when they occur, little things that you think, my God, I can't believe these two things have come together. And yet they do if you put yourself out, you know. I don't want to sound like Leo Buscaglia, but but there's a lot of truth in what he's saying. You know, he's sort of packaging, I think, sort of the best of 60s philosophy for the masses of the 80s.
You create all these wonderful characters, and then you kill some of them. Some of your characters have died. Is it a crisis for you when you kill off one of the characters that you've created?
It's tough, yeah. And I when in writing one of the scenes concerning John's death, I was literally weeping over the typewriter, and a friend of mine walked in on me and said, "My God, it's just like Romancing the Stone." And it was. I remembered when I saw Romancing the Stone, I thought, that's really true. People would never believe it, but writers do weep over their typewriters if they're really attached to the characters and feel a sense of what's going on. And it has been hard, and it's kind of puts me in a difficult position with the fans too. I'm on in the third city of a 12 city tour here, and I've gotten in Boston. One man had about 3 glasses of white wine at a reading I did, and afterwards came up and called me a rather crude name, and I thought, what in the world have I done wrong? And he said, you know, how dare you kill John? And I regard that as a compliment because I know that he now takes the characters seriously enough that he sees them as his, as part of his life and an extension of his life. And having very little to do with me, I'm just the custodian of the characters. It's the same reaction that people who perform in soap operas get, I guess.
Mm-hmm. My guest is writer Armistead Maupin, and he's written several books in a series which is called Tales of the City, and the latest book in that series is called Baby Cakes. Once you started writing this, did it kind of give you an excuse to do things in your own life that you might otherwise have done, or to kind of go into certain scenes that you otherwise might not have bothered with or gone into?
That's what I tell the IRS, for starters. But it's true. You do start manufacturing your own life. You realize if you put yourself in harm's way, so to speak, more interesting things will happen to you. The latest book is partially set in London and the countryside around it. And that grew out of direct experiences. And it makes it so much more vivid for me. I've read about English country houses all my life, but I never actually walked through a bona fide one until a couple of years ago, when sort of a friend introduced me to a seedy lord in Gloucestershire who showed me his house, and it was amazing what it did for my imagination. I just thought, wow, I could see why all these books had been written about English country houses. And it keeps it fresh for me because I think essentially I'm often bringing a reporter's eye to the story, and it's the humor works better for me. The gay scene in London was terribly funny to me because they were imitating the American gay scene of about 1978. So you saw all these sort of village people looking guys walking around speaking with Oxonian accents.
That must have been fun.
Yeah, it was a fascinating experience.
What about in San Francisco? Have you started going to I don't know, neighborhoods or bars or cruising supermarkets, yeah, that you otherwise wouldn't have bothered?
Yeah, I'll just check out new scenes just to verify for myself that I don't like to make it up. I mean, a lot of my imagination is at work, but often it's you do better stretching the truth. Someone told me the other day, a lesbian friend of mine told me that some of the lesbian bars in San Francisco now had strippers. Women strippers a la Gypsy Rose Lee with that started out with cocktail gloves and big dresses, you know, which I thought was fascinating because it didn't seem to fit in with that sort of feminist non-exploitation of women thing that has been the official, at least in San Francisco, lesbian line for many years. So to see how these things are evolving.
That really is interesting. Did you go?
It was intriguing. No, I haven't been yet. I wasn't sure if I was welcome, but I thought I'd check it out.
So do you have informants in the community who are your friends?
Sure. Friends and often anonymously people will call me up and say, you really should check out this, or they'll tell me some outlandish story about what happened at a high society cocktail party the night before.
Speaking of the word community, at the beginning of I forget which novel it is, Michael has a list of like 30 resolutions that he's going to make, and one of them is to never use the expression "gay community." what don't you like about
I try
that
not
expression?
To myself. Well, it's Michael talking, not me entirely, but I've been wary of it because I think it invites an opportunity to sort of create a ghetto where one need not exist. I feel very much a part of the community at large in San Francisco and in the world in general. I mean, part of my coming out was to come out, you know, to feel a part of the world, to feel that I could be who I was amongst my friends, both gay and straight. And to say gay community is to sort of indicate that there's one mindset, there's one group, there's one attitude about anything, and that is simply not true about gay people. And you see the members of the media do it in San Francisco all the time. A recent decision on the closing of the bathhouses in San Francisco, the anchor asked some reporter on the street, well, how does the gay community feel about this? And the reporter answered, well, they're furious. As if you could really say what one-third of the population of San Francisco felt about anything. It often helps, I think, to apply the parallel to, say, an ethnic group, to say, would you say that about black people and feel silly about it? You know, like, what are the Negroes saying about this? You know, it's preposterous, you know. People have different attitudes about different subjects. There has been a necessity for a gay community. I mean, there's been a need for gay people to band together to eliminate those barriers. But I think it's very important to realize when to dissolve that sense of community and to become part of the world at large. Because I think that's when your true satisfaction comes, when you're not making a career out of being oppressed.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it takes time before any oppressed group is able to do that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. What's that? There's a great Eleanor Roosevelt line to the effect of no one can make you feel oppressed and without your consent. Or a second-class citizen. I haven't got it quite right, but it's really true. It's really your own attitude about that. And that's what I try to get across to gay people when I see them. You've got to have your own sense of self-worth intact. And then you're safe and sound. You know, then you can go out and face almost anything and even get to the point of feeling sorry for the people that have such a limited vision of the world that they can't include you in it.
From what I understand, the first book, Tales of the City, that was based on your San Francisco Chronicle series didn't sell very well outside of San Francisco, where people had never heard of the series. But the second book that you did, the publisher hired a gay promotion company to do the promotion for it, and the book did a lot better. What did they do differently than the first promotion group did?
That was in 1980, when the publishing industry at large was relatively unsophisticated about the gay market. They didn't know that there are these established gay and lesbian literature bookstores around the country. They didn't know that there's this whole press system set up in which a whole sense of networking amongst gay people that could be tapped into. It was a very simple thing. They hired a man who had a mailing list, who knew where the gay press was and could send press releases out to gay people in other parts of the country. And that was the germ that started the book spreading through the country. The first book actually ended up in the travel section of a lot of bookstores because it had a map of the city on the cover and people thought it was a guidebook to the city.
Boy, I'm sure they were really surprised if they bought it thinking it would tell them what restaurant to eat at.
Exactly.
But on the other hand, have places that you write about in Tales of the City become landmarks in San Francisco?
Well, Wednesday night at the Marina Safeway is now an established institution. And I've ruined a couple of restaurants. I must admit I've learned my lesson. When I find a nice little out-of-the-way place, I don't put it into Tales of the City anymore. I think the most dramatic example of it was I had a couple of socialites in one episode talking about rushing down to the Twin Peaks grocery, which at the time was a gourmet grocery store, to get a bottle of Ryoko, which is the Brazilian cola with guarana in it, the sort of jungle speed that keeps everybody in Rio sambaing in the streets. And the woman was saying something about it's the most speed you can get without without FDA approval or something to that effect. I was really just making fun of these kind of dizzy socialites rushing off to buy this Brazilian cola. And the man that ran the grocery store, the real-life grocery store, said that morning when he arrived to open the store at 10 o'clock, there was a line of people around the block waiting to buy this stuff.
Gosh, it must really give you pause to realize that the fiction you're creating has such power.
It's satisfying, and it allows you to channel the power into, you can get things said that ordinarily might not be said.
When did you start to write? Were you very young when you started writing?
I did a few things in grammar school, thanks to teachers that kind of encouraged that sort of thing, so I knew that I knew how to do that. My real instinct was storytelling, was oral storytelling. I was the kid at the school picnic that always made everybody sit on the ground and listen to his version of the monkey's paw or whatever. And I realize this. I've been realizing more and more in the last year that's still very much a part of my instinct. I read from the books at various bookstores around the country, and get huge satisfaction out of doing it. When I hear people stand there and laugh at what I've written, it makes me feel just wonderful. It's the best kind of sensation in the world. I always thank them after the reading is over because I feel like they've been indulging me somehow or other. It's enormously satisfying for me.
When did you know you were gay?
When I was 13. I didn't do anything about it till I was twice that age, 26, so I had lots of time to sort things out, I guess.
Why didn't you act on it until then?
I was a good little boy. I believed what I'd heard about homosexuality. There were no role models for me. The only homosexuals that I knew in Raleigh were my mother's hairdresser, who was a horror that would make Liberace look like Clint Eastwood. It just didn't seem that there was any future in it, you know. It was a terrifying prospect for me. Makes me very angry when I think to what degree that's still being perpetrated on children in the South, for instance, and in other places where they're not allowed to hear that you can be gay and still be happy and healthy and lead a good life.
Did you try to force yourself into straight relationships to
do
the right thing?
Yeah, it didn't ever really work out, and I met a lot of nice, indulgent women along the way, some of whom who had a better instinct about me than I did, one in particular that I can think of who's still really one of my dearest friends and corresponds with me and was sending me volumes of Auden's poetry long before I knew why she was sending them to me. It's almost as if she was trying to say, look, you're gay, can't you figure it out?
You went into the service. Did that have anything to do with having an unsatisfying social life?
Well, it did have something to do with my homosexuality, I think, because in a sense I think I was trying to prove myself to my family. I came from a very old-line Southern family with a military history, and it was really, when Vietnam came along, it was described as my war in my family. My father's war was World War II, and Vietnam was my war. Each one, you know, one's provided every generation, you know. And so I think that part of joining the Navy and part of volunteering for Vietnam actually was tied up in that. I'd had a few unsatisfactory sexual relationships in Charleston where I was stationed in the Navy. But it was a pretty dark and terrifying affair. I mean, it was very – people sort of met each other in parked cars, and it all seemed very sordid and unromantic and not what I wanted at all. So I kind of panicked and thought, well, I've got to prove I'm a man. So off I went to Vietnam.
And when you got there, did you think you'd done the right thing?
I had justifications in my head for Vietnam at the time. I really did. I was enormously disillusioned as the year wore on, you know, and I saw how little we knew about anything, including the Vietnamese people. And I was in a relatively non-combatant situation. I was a naval officer stationed in an army camp, and my job was really to tell them not to fire when I could prove that there were friendly people in the area, when there were innocent bystanders. So in that sense, that was satisfying. It was just a way of putting a brake on the war, I guess.
Did you meet other gay men?
I must have. When I look back on it, there are people when I think how what an idiot I was that I didn't figure out that he was gay after he showed me his copy of Auden's suppressed poem or whatever it was. One guy actually had a tape that a friend had made of Boys in the Band, which was a big movie at the time. And I'm sure when I think back on it that he – but I didn't act on it in Vietnam at all. I was too afraid of the consequences.
When did you stop being afraid of the consequences?
Well, in the military, when I was pretty much – I behaved myself in the military, at least by their standards. But to San Francisco really was the first thing that made me much looser about the whole thing. And it wasn't the gay people in San Francisco. It was the straight people. I had a really good woman friend in San Francisco who was married and about 28 or so and had a couple of kids. And she was so good and kind that I felt that it was time to start living my life honestly, since I was having kind of a secret gay life in San Francisco. So I decided to tell her one night, and I got very drunk and came up to her house, and she was washing the kids in the bathtub. And I said, "I have something to tell you, Jan." And she said, "What is it?" And I asked her if she'd come into the living room. So she came in and sat down across from me, and I hemmed and hawed. And finally I said, "I'm a homosexual." And she looked at me for the longest time, and then she came over and sort of knelt in front of me and took my hands and looked up at me and said, "Big effing deal." I've cleaned that up a little bit for
radio.
This is public radio, but I know we can't get too crazy here. But it, you know, it just freed me. I mean, I looked at her and I realized she meant it. You know, she knew plenty of gay men. It was like, what are you tormenting yourself about? Get over it, you know. And it put it all into perspective for me. It made me feel so much better about myself, and I just, my life changed from that moment on.
Did your writing change right away?
I wasn't really writing at the time other than for the Associated Press. I was a reporter for them. And I guess in that respect it did, in that I felt restricted by the reporting, and I had so many more things I wanted to say. I thought, look, the world is changing all around me. For everybody. I could see it with the young women I knew, the single women that were coming to town and were suddenly really taking charge of their own lives just in the way that I was. And it made that natural confederacy between straight women and gay men that was such a very strong supportive thing for me in the beginning.
Do you think that confederacy still exists?
Yeah, to a certain degree. I think it's expanded, really. It partially existed because lesbians and gay men were so separate. And I've seen a wonderful thing happen just in my travels in the last couple of years, in that lesbians and gay men are really beginning to understand each other and respect each other more. And I think it has to do with just becoming sure of themselves, of who they are, and not feeling that kind of competitive friction. Because we as gay people have a special obligation not to be as narrow as our oppressors. And I think a lot of us still are. A lot of us say, oh, breeders, you know, in reference to heterosexuals, you know, who just turn around and, you know, call out another name. And I don't think that that's the message that we have to give the world. I think that, you know, gay people have a special obligation to stay as open as possible, because many of us have seen the world from both sides. And therefore, really should be more open about it.
My guest is writer Armistead Maupin, and he's the author of the Tales of the City books, the latest of which is called Baby Cakes. And these books are rewritten versions of a serial that he'd started in 1976 at the San Francisco Chronicle. If we could get back to your family for a minute. They were the
sure.
ones who described Vietnam as your war.
Right, right.
I can imagine what they had to say when you came out to them.
Well, you know, my father actually found out about it in Newsweek magazine, which
yikes.
Is kind of a rude shock. There was an issue on Anita Bryant in 1977, and they interviewed me about it and referred to me as gay journalist Armistead Maupin. So it was really the best way he could find out about it, because he didn't have to sit around and worry about whether his friends knew. His friends knew. And it sort of eliminated all of those anxieties right at the beginning, you know. And eventually he got to be pretty – he's always had a good sense of humor. I mean, I must have gotten that from somewhere, and I think he's one of the places, a kind of Rabelaisian sense of the ironic that he eventually was able to apply to me. At one point he started telling people that he had three fine children, one of each, meaning my brother, my sister, and me. But they've been pretty good. My mother died about 5 years ago, but before she did, we had everything kind of worked out. She had cancer, and actually spent some time with my father in her hospital room before she died, and she was very lucid and funny and witty and tried to fix me up with her orderly just before she died.
I guess when your father found out from Time magazine that Armistead Maupin, gay journalist, had said something or another, he couldn't dismiss it and say, must have been another Armistead Maupin.
Exactly. Actually, his name is Armistead Maupin, so it's...
He knew he didn't say it.
Yeah, he said... he actually called up and said, if you're going to run around saying these damn things, I wish you'd put the junior back on your name.
You live in the Castro area now?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How come you live there? Do you like the neighborhood a lot? It's a big gay
yeah.
neighborhood, but
no,
you probably have the money now to live wherever you pleased.
Well, actually, I'd lived on Telegraph on Russian Hill for 5 years and on Telegraph Hill for 5 years, but I moved to the Castro because my rent went up so high on Telegraph Hill that I just didn't feel that I didn't want to spend that kind of money. And I wanted a new part of town, and it's really sunny over there. I have a little cottage on the very top of the hill, so it's removed from the hubbub of the mostly tourists coming down Castro Street. And yet there is a sense of neighborhood there, a kind of villagey feeling that I like a lot. I haven't been in a bar there in 2 years because it's just a scene that strikes me as totally purposeless. But I like it very much. My neighbors are actually, an interesting mix of people. I have a 95-year-old Alsatian woman who lives right over the back fence from me, and she's always sort of passing strudel over the fence and telling me if it hadn't been for her husband that she'd still be living in Paris and having free love, as she puts it.
Does she read your stuff?
No, I don't think she even knows what I do, which I kind of like. She just relates to me as a neighbor.
You wrote a story about Jacqueline Onassis called Jackie Old, and you're writing another – well, no, there's a comic book based on this story.
There's a comic book based on the story. Yeah.
And you've also had a Nancy Reagan character in some of your writing too, right?
I don't think I've actually used Nancy Reagan. I may have right. – I know. In Baby Cakes, she's a sort of – she's talked about by a society matron. Because part of it takes place when Queen Elizabeth visits San Francisco, and of course the Reagans were there.
What interests you about that element of high society?
Oh, I guess the degree to which they take themselves so seriously, which is such a great source of humor. It's really not high society at all, but a kind of 80s bourgeoisie that is just full of high comedy. The Reagans epitomize it, you know. Any woman that thinks that Betsy Bloomingdale is high society, for instance, is hasn't quite got it right. I mean, it's a whole mercantile, sleazy thing that appeal. It's like the people that Dickens wrote about in his time, you know, that he had these people who were just ridiculous, who thought they were so grand and who really didn't even get any close and get close to what they aspired to. I mean, here's the First Lady of the United States, you know, the wife of the president of the supposedly, you know, the great powerful nation of the earth, falling all over herself because Queen Elizabeth has come to town, you know, who was virtually curtsying, not because of any relationship between England and America, but because she just saw Betty Windsor as the queen of society.
I know you write for Interview Magazine sometimes, and it seems to me that Interview Magazine has somehow started to take that part of society very, very seriously. And,
it
and
has.
Very literally,
it's a horrifying
too.
Thing, isn't it?
What happened?
I don't know exactly. It's very hard to say. Doria Reagan, Ron Reagan's wife, works for the magazine. And Bob Colicello, who used to be editor, was very right-wing Republican and was sort of in love with the Reagans. And I think that kind of introduced it. And I think Andy Warhol went along with it because he's just kind of fascinated by fame and money, period, and knows that other people are and that you can always sell that. So that's my only explanation for it. But it is an amazing story. I think that has yet to be written, how it's moved from those days of Edie Sedgwick and all the 60s anarchism of Interview Magazine to this, relatively pretentious high-tone magazine. I don't think I'm biting the hand that feeds me to say that because what I do for it, I like very much. I get to meet people that, I did interviews with Bette Midler and Diane Cannon that I think I brought my own personality to. But it is very strange and puzzling to me sometimes.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the projects you have in the works now?
I was just asked last night by John Glines, of who's most famous as the man who thanked his lover when he won the Tony for Torch Song Trilogy, the producer of Torch Song Trilogy, asked me to write a one-act play for a sort of festival of one-act plays that he's putting on this spring in New York in an off-Broadway theater. And since I've not done any theater, I thought it was a fascinating challenge, and I think I'm going to sit down and try my hand at it. In the meantime, I've contracted with Harper and Row for another book, which will be out in 2 years.
Do you want to start up the series again at the San Francisco Chronicle?
I don't think so. The last time was especially tough because I had begun to think in terms of the finished novel as opposed to these daily episodes with a cliffhanger every day. And it's very hard to please a daily audience and to also write an effective novel. And there's an ever-growing audience for the book, so I think it would almost be more interesting to have the suspense of waiting for the book to come out. In the past, people were fans of it in the other parts of the country, were getting Xeroxes from their friends in San Francisco, so they were a little bit tipped off as to what was happening, and I'd like to really, keep the suspense up.
Can I just ask you, was this really an ad? One of the characters in, I think it's Baby Cakes, is reading an ad in The Advocate. And it's for jewelry that says, "I'm safe, are you?"
Yeah, that came right straight out of The Advocate. I couldn't believe it when I saw it. Saying it was a great an icebreaker if you're sitting in a bar that you're wearing a pin that says, "I'm safe." How anybody could know that in the first place is amazing. But they were suggesting that in this era of AIDS and herpes, that things were so risky that you really should have a piece of jewelry indicating that you were disease-free.
You must have a whole, like, truth is stranger than fiction file that you put all this stuff in and then use it in your novels.
It amazes me sometimes that you can't make it up. You can't make it any better than it already is. In the latest book, I have a thing in which Marianne goes out to cover a story about a woman who's seen the face of Jesus on a tortilla, which, if you recall, actually happened. And in the real story, the reporter had a problem with the tortilla because part of it was missing. And when they asked the person why the tortilla had been cut off, she said, "Oh, well, that's where my mother put the guacamole before she saw Jesus." and you just think, you can't make this stuff up. You just have to go, you have to use it. Embellish a little, maybe.
Well, it's really been fun to talk with you, and I want to thank you a lot for being with us here on Fresh Air today.
Thanks. It's been great to be here.